site-specific facility sources of greenhouse gas pollution, the most detailed inventory ever assembled that can be used to identify exactly where all this pollution is coming from. There is a path that we can make from here to a future with hope. As a final point, I started by saying that we have a credibility problem, but we also have the ability to address it. And if anyone doubts that we can summon the political will to do what is necessary and to save our future, always remember that political will is itself a renewable resource. Thank you.
That was Vice President Al Gore speaking at the United Nations COP27 climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Stay tuned for more of The Rotten Truth and Tiny Hope next week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
This is Cy Khan here at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, a liberated zone. Listen to community radio, support community radio. It belongs to us.
Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr. Chris Abani is an acclaimed poet and novelist. His most recent books are The Secret History of Las Vegas and The Face, A Cartography of the Void, and Sanctificum. He has received a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Penn Hemingway Award, an Edgar Award, and many others. Born in Nigeria, he is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a board trustee professor of English at Northwestern University. He lives in Chicago. Goodreads calls Smoking the Bible his latest book of poetry, an arresting collection of poems thick with feeling, shaped by Chris Abani's astounding command of form and metaphor. These poems reveal the personal story of two brothers, one elegizing the other, and the larger story of a man in exile, exile of geography, culture, and memory. This interview with Chris Abani about his new collection of poetry will air in two parts. I hope you enjoy part one, and if you'd like to hear more, part two airs December 29th. Welcome to Between the Covers, Chris Abani.
Thank you, Abby. It's so much fun to be here with you.
Your new book of poems is dedicated to your older brother, Gregory, who passed away, and to your baby daughter. Can you speak a bit about where and when you and Gregory grew up with your siblings?
So, well, yeah, in multiple places. So we were born, all of us, except for my sister was born a different time, but all in Afiko in Nigeria. And then we sort of left the country during the Biafran Civil War. Then we were in England for a while. And then we came back, and then we lived in Nigeria for the bulk of most of our childhood until early adulthood, with, you know, trips back and forth. And then we didn't live in the same town the whole time. My dad was good at wrangling difficult situations. So they used to send him into schools. My dad was a principal for a while, and they would send him into high schools where you had kids who had been former boy soldiers and often were still armed. And so his job was essentially to make sure that he could disarm them, take their guns, keep them in school, and not go do heists in the evening to earn money for their families. So, he was a complicated man in so many ways. But yeah, so we moved around a lot. But my father, Nigeria required, you know, upper middle class, but in a way, it was interesting to grow up with those kinds of class privileges, but in rural areas, because my dad never bribed anyone for a prime job posting. So it was really one, you know, when it was going on, I hated every minute. But that's not true, because when you're a kid, you don't really know. But I think as a teenager, there were things I had wished for otherwise. But then as you become an adult, you realize what a wonderful gift you've been given, in sort of not just in terms of linguistic and artistic and intellectual privileges and exposures, but also contrast and a sense of self that is so robust. It's more robust even than I think you're sort of a Western privileged middle class person grows up with, because it's rooted in an ancient self and in a modern self. Yeah, so that's the beauty of that. So usually how it works where I was growing up, traditionally, the natural planning for families tends to be every 3 years. Kids come every 3 years, because then it gives the mother's time to wean and for the child to get a good amount of attention. And then also because we grow up a lot in peer age group systems. And so unlike here, you tend to be left alone with your peer group, and like maybe one a group ahead of you and one group behind. And so it's like a really amazing way to grow up, because you learn self-regulation. It's sort of what ideally I think schools should have been. My two elder brothers ended up 2 years apart, and then there's 4 years between Greg and I, and then there's 18 months between my sister and I. But Greg and I, you know, boys have a thing anyway, and so we were the two closest boys. And so we were shadows of each other. There were all these ways in which Greg took care of me in the world, and there were all these ways in which I was Greg's caretaker in the world. And so it was sort of a remarkable relationship. Mm. Yeah.
Could we hear an excavation?
Certainly. I did that mostly for effect. I'm just saying, your radio listeners, because then it makes it sound like the poem is more profound than it is. Excavation. Excavation is a poem sort of written for my friend David Doris. David Doris is an African art historian here in the U.S. and really takes African art history almost into a metaphysical level. And he's very interested in earthworms. And if you've seen certain African sculptures, this will make sense to you. But it's also linked to ideas of Darwinian evolution. You know, Darwin has sort of, he has a whole book on earthworms. I don't know, people don't really know this part of his previous, but it turns out that every particle of sand, every piece of this planet has passed through the digestive system of a worm. And so it's sort of looking at all the different levels and what that can mean, both metaphysically, psychically, and otherwise. Excavation, for David Doris. The fecund smell of loam, rotten wood, mushroom, and beets. Other things also, earthworms at their workings. They eat and excrete every grain of earth. an eternity of sustenance and renewal, a world reformed. Brother, our love is an endless summer turned over and over, and yet so much is still this, that we are deformed early, the pattern set still. Curry still smells good, rhubarb baked in a pie, tea heavy with milk and sugar reminds us that failure is sated only for that moment, mitigated for a while between the aroma of preparation and the last scrape of the fork.
So I'd love to use that poem to start to talk about the themes that are in this particular collection. Cycles of wounding and love and rebirth go throughout the book. I was curious about the line, failure is sated only for that moment, though. That was the one that caught me.
Well, I think that well, there are multiple ways to think of this, but if we sort of start from the contemporaneousness of where we're standing, English today is I've been in meetings all day, so I'm a bit tongue-tied. But so particularly in an American system, failure is criminalized. And the truth of the matter is we can only learn by failing. You have to fail spectacularly to learn spectacularly. So I would actually, and so I'm not using failure in the ways we have been taught to think of it as a dirty word, as sort of not being able to pull off something, but by the very fact that growth and transformation is dependent on finding where your will is thwarted by a thing bigger than you, older than you, and that really growth is sort of, you have to fail in order to release ego. And I don't mean ego sometimes in the way people think of ego, which may be pride, or it's literally just the compulsions that you carry have to surrender for in the face of larger, older, primordial things. And so growing up where I grew up, initiations are still marked, rites of passages in multiple ways, whether you have been initiated into a cult of a god or a goddess, or whether it's just rituals of transition like manhood and womanhood and so forth. And so really, you can think of it in a very Jungian way. It's really the idea that you are initiated into myth. So really myth, you know, the myth, the way we use it now, is just folk tales. It's folklore. There are no living Greeks of that time. So what Western civilization builds itself on Greek mythology, which is already a lie because it's not really Greek mythology. It's 19th century British excavations of Greek mythology kind of bent into English Victorianism. So it's essentially you're taking a myth that's dead. And for myth to really do its work, myth has to be a living thing. And so the process is really the initiation of the small individual unconscious in relationship to the larger collective in which you have to negotiate your whole life. And that collective starts, we can say, even within the social contract, but then escalates into nature itself. So it allows you to figure out what is phenomenon that you can't even worry about, what is within your control, what is not within your control. And you have to, and it teaches you how to negotiate how far the individual gets to be expressive and not upset the collective, but also how the limits the collective can have on the individual. So that means that everything you do has to fail because there's no real roadmap. There's only these sort of psychological sort of like revelations. So for me, a really well-lived life is a life where you fail continuously to remain as the id, right? To have your own way. Because that's really what the id is. It's the desire to have your own way. And it's really difficult in a Western context to surrender that because so much is made about the individual and everything's about the individual. But then what the true problem is, the individual cannot hold the weight of the collective. And this is why I think you find in different cultures, different neuroses and different psychological components. So for me, that line is really the first failure, which is really a process of constant initiation. And so then the idea that you're having sweet tea is essentially heavy black tea. I guess, like, when I mean heavy, like, it's really the tannin can literally cut the tongue, but it's saturated in condensed milk and sugar. So it's clove, and then sometimes you'll have cloves and other things. So it's very akin to like the chai you would get in India. And so what it does is it has a way of cutting not just the satan, not just the hunger of the body, but there's something about that comfort that it dulls the pain of transformation. But because transformation is all there is, it's only momentary. And then you kind of have to put the cup down and kind of wade back into the fray. I remember as a kid growing up, I don't know if you had these in America, but there used to be these comic books called Asterix the Gaul. And it was all about the French Gaelics fighting the Romans, but they all, for some reason, had English accents. But the Gauls were at one point fighting the British, and the British would knock off at four to have tea, and so it used to drive Asterix crazy. This idea that there can be a sort of a pause in a battle to have tea, but I think that's really what this book is sort of talking about, that what you think is you is the smallest part of what you are, and that you are part of in the culture I grew up in. When people meet you, they say, who claims you? They don't ask you your name, they ask you who claims you, and you would start with a clan name, and then maybe they would ask a family name. And if they figured out that who claimed you was worthy of conversation, then they would ask your name. So this is a constant reminder that you are part of a larger thing, and that you, whatever is unique about you, is possible only within the permission allowed by the larger things that claim you. So life is a constant negotiation with occasional stops for sweet tea.
Well, I like that as a segue to my next question, that idea of who are you claimed by, because the theme of becoming a man, you and your brother moving through childhood, you share this childhood in the shadow of a violent father. He's very central throughout the book. Your father has such an intense presence. How do you see your father's influence on your relationship with your brother?
So, you know, my father's generation suffered great injustices, because here are people who were raised in the old ways. They were raised to be warriors. There was a certain kind of coming of age. There was a certain balance of things that were needed to, and this would have been true in every old culture. Now, it would even in American West, you see this. You know, people lived with difficulty, but then they were the elite. My father went to Oxford. Sort of, what do you do with all of that stuff that is bred within you? So traditionally, there were systems in place. There was even, so there's a word that appears in some of the poems called Jujwa. It's a beautiful word. Jujwa means to enter a state of calm. So if you were with a friend and then they were getting irate and they wanted to fight someone, you know, an older person would just put their hand on your shoulder as a young man and just say, Jujwa nanna, Jujwa. And there's such an affection to it. That these are sort of the ways in which men expressed affection and expressed a tenderness that had disappeared then in the Victorian colonialism. And then in those days, there were actual places called Ijujago, where you calm the leopard. So when men went to fight wars, whatever they did, the things that men would do, you would come back to this place that was away from the other community, and you lived with other warriors, and slowly you were reintegrated into the community. You could visit after, you couldn't see or talk to anyone but the men who took care of you in that place for like maybe a month. All the cooking, everything was done there. Then slowly your family would bring food and then you'd be reintroduced. So how to deal with PTSD, all of these things were built into a traditional culture that the British eroded. And then the British offered no, well, even to today, the British are not really good with psychological selves, right? So there's no alternative for these men. And so then for some, you know, people are different, and some people just had a way of dissipating the anger, and for others it sort of translated into trying to form their sons into these schizophrenic sense of manhood. And so with my father it was difficult. So part of what was beautiful for me is I grew up with a generation older than my father. Like my grandfather, I was often around very old people, men and women, who remembered a different time. And so like this saved me, and these are the ways in which I was able to be of service to my brother who didn't. And so it was difficult. There's a, you know, men differentiate themselves through violence, no matter how subtle it is. Even to be a good football player in America, it's rugby. All of these are sort of simulated war games. And so if you had a father who had a strong will, and basically you spend your whole life as a young man rebelling against him, and if he was someone who believed in a sort of a heavier hand, then so in this way, my brother and I, who were oddly outsiders in different ways, my brother was just an out-and-out rebel. Like Greg once set fire to a corn farm, a whole maize farm, and because he was angry, obviously. And then I remember my dad asked him, he said, "I just wanted to eat roasted corn." You know, this is the kind of things he would do. I was sort of the good boy, but then internally this weird mystical creature. So I think that that's what when we were, and we were closer in age, my two elder brothers were away in school. So I think that it forged between us that kind of peer thing I was talking about, how we raised each other. So we were, you know, each other's. Greg was sort of better with facing down danger in the world, and I was better with facing down danger in the psyche. And so I think that is what we were for each other.
One of my favorite aspects of the book's exploration is the way that you approach wrestling with anger. Where someone else might just describe anger, violence, and aggression, your poems reach under the expression of it, past someone's actions, and look for what's inside or the wound that's underneath it. I'm not sure, I was trying to think of what the right word would be for it, but I know you'll help me with it. But what have you learned over time, now that you're looking back at it, now that you're a father, at what the wound was specifically for your father?
Well, that's a good question. I think that being raised by the older generation, so most of us are raised in received narrative. So we're told what the world is, which is narrated for us. And then some of us butt against that, but then very quickly settle into it. And then for so many people, the world is finished by the time they're 20. It's just, and then they seek affirmation for this finished worldview. And for some, it's never finished. And so they're always kind of outliers. So, but I was raised in a culture where it was very clear that symptoms were never the problem. It was to get to the root cause of everything. And that's also sort of this spiritual, psychological path I walk, in the traditional spiritual paths. So I sort of was, I'm always intrigued by that. And even when I teach, I'm always sort of, students are always shocked when I say things like, the story lies in the deepest wound of the protagonist. So I think it's important to sort of figure out that there is a difference between a wound and being wounded. When you're wounded, it's a festering thing and it can only produce negative things. So even sometimes what we call anger is not really anger, it's bitterness. And that is a rancid thing. It can express itself in a language that seems like anger, but it's not really anger at all. It's vengeance. It's a self-serving vengeance. Good anger is liberating. It's sort of like, it's a release. And it's also helps define the world around you and sort of is a signal sometimes to people how to negotiate with you. So I think that's really what I do. But and also, as a writer, I don't believe, and this is what I think makes my work challenging for a lot of people, it's not even so much the subject matters that I write about, but that I remove several things. I remove the moral order. So there's no clear, dependable moral order, and people don't realize how much of what they consume comes with a moral order. Even Apple versus PC has a moral order built into it. And so what it is you confront the randomness of things and the kind of unfettered thing, the feral nature that we all carry. And then it's up to the reader to figure out where they stand with that. So it enacts it. So the real purpose is to dissolve the distance between what the thing is about and its enactment, so that the reader is not observing something, they are inside the thing in a way. So it's almost akin to, you know, if you watch people who dress up like football players to watch football. And so I'm always like, well, do you dress up in scrubs to watch ER? Because that's awesome. But it's sort of like there is a ritual preparation that kind of puts you in there. And that's what I do with the material, because it's, I think that empathy is not a good thing to have in most situations, because empathy means that you have dissolved yourself into whatever's going on. So you can't be useful to people when you're empathetic. If you imagine a child having a tantrum, to be empathetic means you have to have a tantrum. It's not a useful thing for you. So all these words, you know, this is a part of the thing, like I'm a poet and a writer, but so I think we use language in very sloppy ways in modern contexts. So I'm not really a fan of the word empathy. It's actually more selfish than it sounds, because it means you indulge in with what's being presented to you, and in a way you've made it yours. And I think sympathy is a distancing mechanism, because to be sympathetic means to sound like you can sympathize but maintain a distance. So over years I've come to realize that compassion is the harder thing. So the compassion is the capacity to be what is needed at the time for a person, while understanding simultaneously where something is coming from, but knowing that it has to be channeled somewhere different. So like if you see really skilled parents, I'm becoming a parent because that came up. I was watching a kid have a meltdown in the supermarket recently, and all that stuff I would just walk away from. But now it's like, my kid was in school at the time, in preschool, and so I thought, what would I do? So I started to think about this stuff differently. And I watched multiple parents get embarrassed, try to shut the kid down, try to hurry them out. So I just watched this woman just sit on the floor with her kid throwing a tantrum in Target, and just like, yeah, you're right. Because it seemed like she understood that you can't interrupt that. So what she did was to contain it so that it stayed where it was. The kid, she just held the kid in a way that meant the kid couldn't harm themselves, and then that the kid knows that they're safe. But then she sort of let that storm work its way out, and then she moved on. And that I think is really what I think a good book or a good poem should do. It should be the place in which all of our anger and all of the darkness can be revealed outside of judgment, contained so that it doesn't become destructive in the world, and then becomes a way to process a kind of transformation. So that's kind of how I try to work under the seam of something. Because there's something oddly disruptive when you take away the moral order, because people indulge things that they don't believe they have, and then they catch themselves, and then they have to make a negotiation. And I think that's where and it's disturbing for a lot of people, and they shy away from it because all these other things come up. But I think that that's really the gift I was given as I was growing up.
I think that's something, I couldn't quite get the words of how I wanted to ask the question, but I think your use of the storm is a really nice way for us to look at it. Like you let all the wind and the rain come out of it, but then what we are left with, I think, because of your refusal for judgment, is that we end up sort of disquieted around, I felt like you were bringing forward by letting that stuff out, you were bringing forward this question of what was your father, like the word I came up with was misguided intention, like that his misguided intention was applied to his children, because you refuse to put any judgment on him, but you present all of it together. And that's something I think is very unique in your work, is this sort of disinterest in the act itself and more of an interest in what was he doing when he was scanning the perimeter at night? What was he doing when he came at Gregory, right? It made the reader have to occupy that curiosity rather than sit in judgment.
Well, and I think that that's a very good way to talk about it. And if you also have the storm, you know, the great thing about a thunderstorm, once it passes, everything is fresh and new again. Like literally the earth starts to grow better, things. So it is really a true metaphor for the transformation. But, you know, also I think one of the ways you know you've finally grown up is when you can see a parent as a person and you realize that they don't know, they can't teach you anything anymore. They probably never could. You start to see how ill-equipped they are. You start to see, you can understand all the work that is actually needed for you to be a person in the world. Like, parenting doesn't, is not, there's no magical gene that unlocks when that happens. It's a product of the person you are. And so for someone like my father, you know, so I found a picture of my father when he was 23. My father looked 13 in that photograph, and he's flanked on either side by these two huge 6 foot ruddy white Irish priests, because my grandfather was a houseboy to the priest. So my father went first to Cork in Ireland and then on to Oxford on Catholic scholarships. When I looked at the picture, when my father was a young man, he was a beautiful man. Now, I don't know what happened to him. Well, I know for a fact that his own father didn't want him to be educated beyond him, right? Because of his own misgivings. You know, a lot of trauma is generational. And then, so he had to deal with that. But then, you know, even when I was in primary school in Nigeria, corporal punishment was standard. Like, you didn't feel you're being abused when the teacher hit you. It's just like they hit everybody. So I don't know how worse that was when my father was coming up. You know, later stuff that's sort of emerged into the priesthood is like, was my father raped by priests? Would he ever have even been able to hold that cognitively, much less pass it on? So part of this is what I'm talking about, compassion, because part of what happens is you look back at the raging storm that's been coming at you. And also my father, I remember my father just before he passed, even though I was estranged from him, you know, my siblings were not. And I saw this photograph of this diminished man. This used to be a tornado coming at me, and here's this frail human being. And so your ability to look back and sort of imagine them as people, and in a way trying to do what they thought was best for you. Because there's so many things that he did that were amazing. And that's the other difficult thing. You know, I work with students who write memoir. And, you know, most everybody who writes memoir about their parents is always writing about abuse or trauma. And then usually we get to a point where I give them the instruction to remember one thing that is heartwarming. And they suddenly realize multiple things emerge, but that their mind has erased those things from memory in order for this other story, because they're embattled at the time, and so they're seeking protection. So I'm not really interested in the facts of trauma, because that's not what trauma is. Trauma is a lingering, unprocessed story that you keep adding to until it accretes into a thing that doesn't resemble anything like the act. And that is really what trauma is. And so if it can be into, this is what I was saying was so skillful about that parent, because I watch my wife do this, I don't have the same capacity she does. It doesn't matter how tired she is, she never reacts. She just, there's this calming thing she presents to the child. And I just watch, Lola just calm down immediately. And so I realized that this kid isn't building trauma, because whatever difficulty that has come towards her has allowed a certain space to dissipate. And it's when it can't find an escape that the reinscription over and over again, I think, is what trauma really is. Mm. And it's so hard when you then, if you're a therapist or a counselor or a spiritual advisor, and then you get someone in their adulthood, and then you're trying to negotiate with them and sort of say, well, maybe you can let go of this little part. And then they're like, no, but that's, and it becomes the identity. And so I think that I was just always raised by this very old man who I would call grandfather, who just always said to me, Owage bo waibo, your world is the world you are. And so even in the right and even in the work, sort of, it's a bit like the Gandhi thing, you know, be the change you want to see, but not in a hallmarky way. It's really hard work. It's really hard work. But that's, I think that drives a lot of my work. It's sort of figuring out how to tell the full story. Mm. And to tell a full story, it means there can be no judgment, because judgment is just shame. And shaming is just already a limited version of everything. And if you shame, if your work is to shame others, then you are directly a person who shames themselves. And only bitterness comes from shame. Nothing good ever has come from shame. At least raised Catholic, that's what I think. What do I know?
Can we read another poem?
Certainly. Which one would you like?
White Egret.
Okay, White Egret. So birds always play a really important part in what I do, because they play an important part in the culture. So birds in West African, particularly Igbo and Yoruba, symbolism represent the highest parts of the mind, the ability to soar, right, above things. So because they believe that what makes the human being complex is the only creature that can model the world in 3D and then run simulations. And so the job is to take that part and integrate it with all the other parts that are like the sort of crocodile brain and all those sort of, so that is what makes a complete person. White Egret, epigraph. The whole world is filled with the love of God, Kwame Dawes. A stream and a forest and a boy fishing, heart aflame, head hush, tasting the world lick and pant. The holy scripture is animal, not book. I should know. I have smoked the soul of God, psalm burning between fingers on an African afternoon. And how is it that death can open up an alleluia from the core of a man? And how easily the profound fritters away in words, and the simple wisdom of my brother, what you taste with abandon, even God cannot take from you. All my life, men with blackened insides have fought to keep the flutter of a white egret in my chest from bursting into flight, into glory.
I was going to ask you about birds in that, so I'm glad that you explained that ahead of time. But the Holy Scripture is animal. Birds play a major part throughout this collection. How do you think they function? And I don't know if I'm using the right word. Is it as a motif across the collection?
It is as a motif, but it's also kind of what I was speaking to is the kind of symbolism, right? So if you study the ancient world, every advance architecturally, every advance scientifically or otherwise, I would even say even now, is something that has to do with probing into an expansion, into something beyond that we know we have a relationship with, but we can never locate. And so it seems to me that that's really what the bird is. It's sort of like the moving beyond the earth boundness, the limits of body, the limits of mind, the limits of story, and the stories we've been told and the stories we've told ourselves, into something transformational. When I was a kid, they're still growing up in rural parts of Nigeria, they still practiced sort of rotational agriculture, where you would leave places to fall fecund and move to other places, and then after 5 or 6 years you return, and then they would burn the bush in order to, and so burning obviously does multiple things. It clears things rapidly, it creates the necessary kind of potassium, things that get the rain then puts into the earth, so it's like natural fertilizers in a way. But when you watch a forest fire, it's a crazy inferno, because it immolates everything in there, right? So you see small animals who can't escape the flame, but then, you know, it's not like here where it's waste. People, then this becomes food for everyone. But there are two kinds of birds I would notice. One was hawks and eagles. In fact, there's an actual proverb that says that fire cannot destroy the hawk. Instead, it makes it stronger. You would watch them because they're flying over, and they're looking for the burning, running animals, and you see this majestic bird, either a hawk, a kite, or an eagle. These are the three, and they would dive straight into the fire, and you think that's it, they're gone, and they would come back up again. Not a single, they don't even have soot on their wings, and they're holding prey. And so this constant idea of sacrifice and regeneration. So we like to live, to believe we live in a world where everything is possible for everyone, but everything costs something. So whatever you have has, and this is really the question of privilege, right? And so whatever you have costs somebody else something. There's no way around this. And so when you live in the natural world, or you live in observation of the natural world, it's so much easier to understand these concepts. And so people who live in cities are so divorced from it, they don't even recognize a chicken from the supermarket as a chicken that's alive. So there's this constant thing. But then, I remember you would watch small birds who didn't have the power of the larger bird, and you would watch this ricocheting, burning balls of fire as these little birds will try to run. And so you're sitting there, and like birds are coming at you, like someone's throwing live coals at you, and it really does something to you. And I'm not using this in the sort of like the ways we in the modern world we try to reduce everything to like O's and R's, but really the profound. There is a kind of benevolent savagery that the world, the universe exists on transformation, but the transformation is not predicated on a singular need. It's predicated on a larger good and a larger need, and that being good is not the same as being naive, because naive people are dangerous people. And so, and that often what we think of as good people are just law-abiding people. Those are two different things. Goodness requires the capacity for evil and then choosing not to do evil. And so I think that that's partly a lot of how these motifs function for me, is sort of the an understanding of true benevolence. It's not a lack of, it's whatever thing you're dealing with, human idea, concept, or other thing, its capacity, full capacity for destruction, and yet its remarkable tendency towards restoration and redemption. And that what is beautiful is not the same as what is pretty. So what is beautiful at its heart is partly the absorption of what is ugly into a transformation. So I describe these birds to you, but when you're watching living creatures aflame, it's like watching a firework display. It's incredibly beautiful, but that's the cost of it, right? So I think that for me, that's, I'm what you might call a realist optimist. I know I'm not an optimist because I don't understand the cost of it. But what I've noticed is that all of that stuff exists, and yet there always seems to be a larger capacity to arrest disillusion. And that is what I think is real hope. Mm-hmm. This understanding that for in an inexplicable reason, for which we might call love, the world continues to exist in spite of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's where the beauty happens, in spite of everything. That you're watching a small creature on fire, and yet it's beautiful at the same time. And so it's for me, it sort of determines my worldview, which is awe all the time. I'm in constant awe of the place. And so I don't need magical thinking. I don't need, just day-to-day life holds everything beyond anything we can even imagine. So for me, it's sort of the miracle of a black hole and a burning bird. And so, but also when you look through religious texts, you look through spiritual texts, it's the same motif that appears in, you know, the Bible itself, you know, is born of a bird flying over the void and crying out, and then the Elohim appear. So it's sound, the sound of a bird that makes the universe. Mm. So I think that's partly how, but it's sort of the whole idea that, you know, there are no holy scriptures that are not animals. I mean, animal sacrifices abound through them. God's a very animal. They strike you down for whatever. And so it's sort of like you realize that it's that lightning lightning can light your house. I mean, the electricity can light your house, but it can also destroy things. And so it's sort of that implicit. It's never a binary. It's always, in Yoruba we say tako tabo timeta, the one, the male and the female, or this and that make the other. So the mathematics is 1 + 1 = 3, not 1 + 1 = 2, because you already have two. If you have 1 + 1, each one is already 2. So it's sort of a different kind of quantum calculation. So these things flow through my work in these ways. It's a true, I think that is what true sort of worship is. Yeah.
Can we read another poem?
Well, which one are you thinking of now?
How to Write a Love Letter to Your Brother.
How to Write a Love Letter to Your Brother. A train station, silent but for the hum of tracks. An all-night diner in the shadows. Parking lot all but deserted. Places I found you when you ran away from home. The in-between places souls like us haunt, caught in an impossible melancholy, its own sweet addiction. I want to say I love you to all the men our father couldn't be, all the men our brothers are trying to be, and the man you are, a creature iridescent yet wrong for it. I want to say I'm sorry. I wanted to save you. When I fetched you, brother, I fetched you for love, for the sweat of sincere rosaries, a hope of beads, for mother's pleading, her red-eyed worry, for all the ways one cannot speak of an unbearable light, a sky burning, smoke choking birds in flight. When father stepped to you, just before the first blow landed, I heard you begging, negotiating, pleading. What began as words became a keening.
I love that heartbreaking image of smoke choking birds, I guess, as a different side to what you're talking about, as an inability to save someone we love.
Yeah. But you try anyway. There's a beautiful incantation in Ifa, Yoruba Ifa, that is used for water blessings. And it goes like this. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi yo. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi. Awodo yigi yiga wokumo. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi. Afari bale adiki yo. Afari bale adiki. Afari bale awokumo. Afari bale adiki. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi yo. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi. Awodo yigi yiga wokumo. Awodo yigi yigi, ota omi. The unknowable is the thing we must try to untie. Is it the water that shapes the stone at the bottom of the river, or the river, or the stone that shapes the river? We will never know this mystery, and this is why we must die. But every day we must wake up and return to prostrate before the mystery that can never be untied, but that we must wrestle with its knot every day. Is it the water that shapes the stone, or the stone that shapes the water? We will never know, but because we attend to this mystery, because we try to untie the knot, death is not the end. So I think it's this again the privilege of being raised by old people, because their worldview is so, I mean, they're literate in the ways we think literacy is, but that is what allows them to be observational, original thinkers. And so the whole point is not whether you untie the knot or not, but you return to the labor. So, you know, this is why I talk about Greek myth as dead, now folklore, because Sisyphus is used as an example of futility. But actually, Sisyphus is the total example of belief, of the desire, because you can never roll the stone to the top, but you have to roll it up every day and then watch it roll down, and then you start the next day. And I think that that is the attendance, right? The duty of care that we don't even think about. It's not even a word we use in our medical profession, but it is that you owe, we all as people owe a duty of care to other people. We're really good at duty of care to pets, but we're terrible at duty of care to people or to environment or to things that don't feed our own need. And I think that service is truly the only practice that can actually bring you happiness, to serve others. It's a remarkable thing. It's just a remarkable thing that giving away, giving things away. And I don't mean clothes, I just mean giving deep things away. Sitting in witness of other people's difficulty is the thing that actually makes your life full of joy. It seems so odd because we're taught to avoid it, but I think that's really the truth of things.
Well, I think that's what I love so much about the poem is the love between you was you going to find him. The love between him was to
be found.
To be found, even though you were both helpless in the face of what was about to happen again, and you both knew it.
Yeah.
That's what's so beautiful about the poem is that you're wanting to rescue them, you're wanting to rescue the person who's going to beat him, who's going to be, you know, that kind of cyclical way of what you're talking about is so lovely. Does your spiritual practice render the act of art making, transmuting generational personal pain and violence in a way that you can articulate?
The spiritual practice is a complicated thing for me, only in that it's a journey. It's been an unfolding journey. And so it's been my whole life I've been doing different forms of spiritual practice. But I would say the formal initiation into Ifa as a priest of Ifa sort of marks the moment in which a permanent shrine, right, gets established in my home. And so there's something that's markedly different from practicing in corners of your house, and there's another thing where the heart of the house itself is a sacred site. And that it's also over time it's been a shrine that has been a place where people have come to receive initiations and healings, not just by me but by other priests. That marking of that formal practice has done something kind of really remarkable in that it has made the spiritual path, which was, I think, up until that point in my mind, adjacent to my life, the center of the life. And so in retrospect, you start to see how you've been walking on one path your whole life and then watching your shadow on another and then thinking that's you on another path, right? And so the moment you realize that that's just been you the whole time, and so then it becomes inseparable. So I think that part of the journey for me towards spirituality, right? Because there's that beautiful Rumi quote, which everybody uses in a very New Age way, which is, the wound is where the light enters. And it's all very reassuring, but you know, so people skirt the wound or think it just means, you know, oh, I don't know, my dilettante kind of, whatever it is, sophomoric ideas of self. But it really is the idea that to embark on a life of purpose, you need friction. Something has to set you off. And if you really then set off on that path, it's not easy. I wouldn't even call it pleasant, but it becomes necessary. And you start to uncover things. And so you realize in many ways. So in Igbo cosmology, there's something we call Agwo. And everybody has Agwo. Agwo would be what you might think of as the gifts of the Holy Spirit. But it's not in a woo way. It just means when you arrive in this life, you are equipped with certain things to help you on this particular journey. And so this, of course, assumes you believe in reincarnation, and if you don't, just think of it as a certain set of predilections that form your own individuality. They guide you. These things become a help for you. So I would say that my path, the wound that sets off, is the need to integrate, is the need to pull myself together in an intriguing way. And so that is a form of transmutation. I would say then, in that sense, my whole life has been a path of transmutation. Maybe that's why the art itself leans so heavily into that. And maybe that is one of the algal gifts that makes it possible for that to happen, in a way that when I assemble the words in a particular order, a resonance occurs that is maybe beyond what we can think of as craft or gift or skill. Mm. But that is the part of this mystery that we encounter in life, right? So it's more than likely that is happening in the work. But I think that the other part, though, is that there is still the skill and the necessary ways to build the basket to hold all of that. Otherwise, it'll be like pouring hot molten liquid into papyrus. It will just burn its way through. So there has to be enough tensility to hold a fixed thing.
I think it's a really lovely approach of how to describe what people love about your work and how it touches them so deeply, is that it's this transmutation of sort of heavy metal. But I like the point that you're saying, that in a way it helps hold and create a container through which it can come through.
And that's what the craft is. I mean, it's also... And it's not easy on the person who's making it, and it's certainly not easy even on the readers. The readers can escape it, like they can just shut the book. Or, as I've had videos sent to me, sometimes people burn the book. But that's part of the deal you make when you settle into who you are, as a, not even just as a writer, but as a person. You kind of settle into, and not in the easy way of this is a story that I'm going to live by, but rather the uneasy way of sort of going, I've tried to avoid this, but this is just where it at. And so, I mean, Viktor Frankl said this really beautiful thing, right? That which must give light must endure the burning. And so, yeah, there is no way if the work is to have resonance. And I think it's not unusual that a lot of artistic leaning people do lean in towards this. And those who don't have the gift of certain kind of lineages or even the ability to step into a path to follow, you probably explains why there was so much alcohol in some people's life and so many drugs and so many other things, because there had to be something to mitigate. When you're on a journey, because all spiritual journeys are psychological journeys, I mean, we're still only ever trying to explore human potential, that I think that what that allows you to do is to place weight where weight should be placed. And so by that I mean there is a limit to reason, or what we think of as the intellect. And if you believe that you are a rational being, which is the most ridiculous thing, or that the world is rational, or that science can make the world rational, in fact what science does is show you how irrational the world is, that then you are placing a burden on a faculty that cannot sustain it, and that will just produce remarkable tearing in your own psyche, which in its worst cases can lead to psychosis. And I mean, this is really why people talk about stories' ability to kill, right? So it's sort of like you have to kind of learn when things are not you and when things are you, and even the not you is you, but you have to kind of give it something slightly away from you, otherwise how do you function daily? So one protection could either be to be completely arrogant in this way that some artists become, or about specialness and whatever, and then the other way is to be completely unable to function and then placing that burden on other people around you, right? So you still have to learn to live as a competent person. So I think this is where the idea, whatever that is for people, of awe, of being able to put things at the feet of a mountain or something bigger than you, to fall into your knees in the grass, or to go for a run, whatever it is that allows you to bifurcate so that your reason doesn't have to pretend it can carry.
So thank you, Chris Obani.
Thank you, Abby. Thank you.
If you'd like to hear more of this interview with Chris Obani, tune into part two on Between the Covers, December 29th.
KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria.